The multiplier is an investor. The following summarizes the five vital disciplines that differentiate diminishers and multipliers. The five disciplines of the multipliers. The diminisher is an empire builder who hoards resources and underutilizes talent. The multiplier is a talent magnet who attracts talented people and uses them at their highest point of contribution. The diminisher is a tyrant who creates a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capability. The multiplier is a liberator that creates an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and work. The diminisher is a know-it-all who gives directives that showcase how much they know. The multiplier is a challenger who defines an opportunity that causes people to stretch. The diminisher is a decision maker who makes centralized, abrupt decisions that confuse the organization. The multiplier is a debate maker who drives sound decisions through rigorous debate. The diminisher is a micromanager who drives results through their personal involvement. The multiplier is an investor who gives other people the ownership for results and invests in their success. Surprising findings. As we studied multipliers across the world, we found a remarkable amount of consistency and several patterns that confirmed our early observations. But here are three findings that were surprising and intriguing. A hard edge. One of the most critical insights from our study of multipliers is how hard-edged these managers are. They expect great things from their people, and they drive people to achieve extraordinary results. They are beyond results-driven managers. They are tough and exacting. Indeed, multipliers make people feel smart and capable. But multipliers aren't feel-good managers. They look into people and find capability, and they want to access all of it. They utilize people to their fullest. They see a lot, so they expect a lot. During our research interviews, people oozed appreciation for the multipliers they had worked with. But the gratitude was rooted in the deep satisfaction found in working with them, not in the pleasantries of a relationship. One person described working with Deb Lang, a senior vice president of taxation at a large firm. Working with her was like an intense workout. It was exhausting, but totally exhilarating. Another said of his manager, "He got things from me I didn't know I had to give. I would do almost anything to not disappoint him." The multiplier approach to management isn't just an enlightened view of leadership. It's an approach that delivers higher performance because it gets vastly more out of people and returns to them a richly satisfying experience. As one early reader of this book noted, these leaders aren't about cupcakes and kisses. A great sense of humor. It turns out that multipliers have a great sense of humor. On a whim, we added great sense of humor to our leadership survey. Our suspicion proved right. Not only is this trait prominent among multipliers, it is one of the traits that is most negatively correlated with the mindset held by diminishers. Multipliers aren't necessarily comedians, but they don't take themselves or situations too seriously. Perhaps because they don't need to defend their own intelligence, multipliers can laugh at themselves and see comedy in error and in life's foibles. Their sense of humor liberates others. The humor of the multiplier is very George Clooney-esque. A self-deprecating wit and an ability to put others at ease, allowing people to be themselves. As one journalist wrote of Clooney, "After 15 minutes, he made me feel comfortable in my own house." A Clooney co-star said, "He has a way of daring you, which can be irresistible." Multipliers use humor to create comfort and to spark a natural energy and intelligence in others. The accidental diminisher. Perhaps one of our biggest surprises was realizing how few diminishers understood the restrictive impact they were having on others. Most of the diminishers had grown up praised for their personal intelligence and had moved up the management ranks on account of personal and often intellectual merit. When they became the boss, they assumed it was their job to be the smartest and to manage a set of subordinates. Others had once had the mind and even the heart of the multiplier, but they had been working among diminishers for so long that they inherited many of their practices and absorbed their worldview. As one executive put it, "When I read your findings, I realized that I have been living in diminisher land so long that I have gone native." Many people have worked for diminishers, and although they may have escaped unscathed, they carry some of the residual effects in their own leadership. The good news for the accidental diminisher is that there is a viable path to becoming a multiplier. The promise of this book. As we studied multipliers and diminishers, we heard case after case of smart individuals being underutilized by their leaders. We heard their frustration as they told us how little some leaders got from them, despite how hard they were working and how they tried to give more. We learned that it is indeed possible to be both overworked and underutilized. Latent talent exists everywhere. Organizations are replete with under-challenged masses. Multipliers are out there. Multipliers know how to find this dormant intelligence, challenge it, and put it to use at its fullest. They exist in business, in education, in nonprofits, and in government. Consider just a few that you will learn more about later. 1. Narayana Murthy, founder and chairman of India-based Infosys Technologies, who led the company over a 20-year period, growing revenue to $4.6 billion and becoming one of India's largest and most successful companies with over 100,000 professionals, by hiring people smarter than himself, giving them room to contribute, and building a management team that would succeed him without skipping a beat. 2. Sue Siegel, former biotech president turned venture capitalist for More David Au Ventures, whose partner says, "There is a Sue effect. Everything around her gets better and companies grow under her guidance. I often wonder what people are like when they aren't around Sue." 3. Lutz Ziob, general manager of Microsoft Learning, whose team says of him, "He creates an environment where good things happen. He recruits great people, allows them to make mistakes, and ferociously debates the important decisions. He demands our best, but then shares the success with the whole team." 4. Larry Gelwex, head coach of Highland Rugby, whose high school varsity team's record is 392 wins and just 9 losses in 34 years. He attributes this extraordinary record to a deliberate leadership philosophy that engages the intelligence of his players on and off the field. 5. K.R. Sridhar, successful green tech entrepreneur and CEO, who recruits A-plus talent, then gives them an environment with a lot of pressure but very little stress, and allows them to experiment and take risks until the right technology and solutions emerge. Leaders like these provide an aspiration point for those who would be multipliers. The promise of this book is simple. You can be a multiplier. You can create genius around you and receive a higher contribution from your people. You can choose to think like a multiplier and operate like one. This book will show you how, and it will show you why it matters. This is a book for every manager trying to navigate the resource strain of tough economic times. It is a message for leaders who must accomplish more by getting more out of their people. As companies shed excess resources, the need for leaders who can multiply the intelligence and capability around them is more vital than ever. This book is also for the raging multiplier who seeks to better understand what he or she does naturally. It is for the aspiring multiplier who wishes to get the full capability and intelligence from his or her people. And it is most certainly for the diminishers, so they can better understand the negative effects of leadership centered on their own intelligence. It is for every manager seeking the promise of the multiplier, to increase intelligence everywhere and with everyone. As you listen to this book, you will hear a few central messages. 1. Diminishers underutilize people and leave capability on the table. 2. Multipliers increase intelligence in people and in organizations. People actually get smarter and more capable around them. 3. Multipliers leverage their resources. Corporations can get 2x more from their resources by turning their most intelligent resources into intelligence multipliers. Before turning our attention to the practices of the multiplier, let's clarify what this book is not. This book is not a prescription for a nice guy, feel-good model of leadership. It is a hard-edged approach to management that allows people to contribute more of their abilities. And although there will be much discussion of multipliers and diminishers, this book isn't about what they achieve themselves. It is about the impact that these leaders have on others. It is about the impact and the promise of the multiplier. And lastly, the ideas offered in this book are not intended to be terms for labeling your diminishing boss and your colleagues. Rather, it is offered as a framework for helping you to develop the practices of a multiplier. This book has been designed as an end-to-end learning experience, offering an opportunity to both understand and implement the multiplier ideas. This introduction has provided a first glance into the multiplier effect and an overview of what multipliers do. The successive chapters will clarify the difference between multipliers and diminishers and will present the 5 disciplines of the multiplier. You will read stories of real multipliers and diminishers. Be aware that we've changed the diminishers' names and companies for rather obvious reasons. The book concludes with a roadmap for becoming a multiplier. My challenge to you. Although the multiplier-diminisher framework might appear binary, I wish to emphasize that there is a continuum between multipliers and diminishers, with just a small number of people at either polar extreme. Our research showed that most of us fall along this spectrum and have the ability to move toward the side of the multiplier. With the right intent, the multiplier approach to leadership can be developed. The good news is that 1, multipliers are out there. 2, we have studied them to uncover their secrets. And 3, you can learn to become one. And not only can you become a multiplier yourself, you can find and create other multipliers. That will make you a multiplier of multipliers. It is within this context that I challenge you to listen to this book at several levels. At the most fundamental level, you might use it to illuminate what you undoubtedly have experienced, that some leaders create genius while others destroy it. Or you might go beyond this and reflect on the quintessential multipliers and diminishers that have been part of your career and life experience. But perhaps the best way to approach this book is to look beyond the idea that you or your colleagues are multipliers, and instead spot yourself at times in the anatomy of a diminisher. The greatest power of these ideas might be in realizing that you have the mind of a multiplier, but that you've been living in a diminisher world and you've lost your way. Perhaps you are an accidental diminisher. As Greg and I have journeyed into the world of multipliers and diminishers, we have often seen glimpses of ourselves, either in the present or from years past, and have found ways to better exemplify the multiplier in our own work, teaching and coaching leaders around the world. The book is a guide for those of you who wish to follow the path of the multiplier, and like British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli, leave those you meet thinking they, rather than you, are the smartest person in the world. It is a book for executives who want to seed their organization with more multipliers and watch everyone and everything get better. Let me now introduce you to the fascinating and diverse set of leaders we call multipliers. They come from all walks of life, from corporate boardrooms to our school's classrooms, and from the Oval Office to the fields of Africa. We've selected leaders who represent diverse ideologies. I encourage you to learn from everyone, even those whose political views you do not share. I hope you will find their stories, their practices, and their impact as inspiring as we did when we entered their worlds. Chapter 1 Summary. The Multiplier Formula. Multipliers versus diminishers. Multipliers. These leaders are genius makers and bring out the intelligence in others. They build collective viral intelligence in organizations. Diminishers. These leaders are absorbed in their own intelligence, stifle others, and deplete the organization of crucial intelligence and capability. The five disciplines of the multipliers. 1. The talent magnet. Attract and optimize talent. 2. The liberator. Require people's best thinking. 3. The challenger. Extend challenges. 4. The debate maker. Debate decisions. 5. The investor. Instill accountability. The results. By extracting people's full capability, multipliers get twice the capability from people than do diminishers.
Chapter 2. The Talent Magnet. I not only use all the brains that I have, but all that I can borrow. Woodrow Wilson.
When you walk up to the porch of her house in Menlo Park, California, you can sense that Meg Whitman, CEO of eBay, has spent time on the East Coast. With its salt box shape and white wood, it is one of those West Coast houses that looks like it should be in New England. The house just might remind Meg of her time in Cambridge, Massachusetts, while at business school. It was September 2007, and early in the race for the 2008 presidential nomination. There were many interesting candidates vying for the ticket for both parties. That day was a chance for us locals to get a peek at one of the candidates, and for me, it was a chance to extend our research and gain insight into two interesting leaders. As the guests gathered on her backyard lawn, Meg Whitman took the microphone and began to introduce Mitt Romney as a candidate for President of the United States. Her introduction was simple. I was a young consultant at Bain & Company and had the good fortune to work for Mitt Romney early in my career. After we were hired, all the new consultants scrambled to get on Mitt's project teams. Why? The word spread that he was the best boss to work for because he knew how to lead a team and he grew his people. Everyone grew around Mitt. You can imagine Meg, a newly minted Harvard MBA, ready to make her mark on the business world. Like many MBAs, she chose to begin her career at Bain & Company, an elite business consulting firm. But she knew landing in the right place inside would determine how quickly she'd learn and advance her career and her value in the marketplace. She heard from one of the more senior consultants, "If you're smart, you'll find a spot on Mitt Romney's team." She didn't quite know why Mitt was such a great boss, but being savvy, she maneuvered her way onto his team. She learned why when she started working with him. On Mitt's team, people were engaged. He took the time to get to know each person and to understand the capabilities they brought to the team. This went well beyond reviewing their resume. Mitt would determine what people were naturally good at and find a way to use those talents with the client engagement. In assigning people to roles, Mitt asked questions like, "What is the next challenge for you? What would be a stretch assignment?" It wasn't unusual for someone on Mitt's team to get loaned to another group if their skills could help rescue a troubled project. In one-on-one meetings, Mitt not only asked about the status of project deliverables, he asked about the blockers. A favorite question was, What is getting in the way of your being successful? Meanwhile, many of Meg's colleagues didn't get the same guidance and found themselves working for more typical company leaders who appeared more concerned with advancing their own careers than growing the people on their team. Team meetings typically consisted of long briefings from project leaders, followed by the usual project updates from each of the consultants who reported on progress in their functional area. People stuck to their roles on the team. When one person was struggling, he or she usually just suffered in silence and pulled a few all-nighters rather than relying on help from colleagues. The job got done, but individual efforts were not acknowledged. The only visible recognition was kudos given to the project leader and an increase in the size of his or her organization. As for the destiny of the project members, they were almost certainly guaranteed a role on the next project that closely resembled what they had done on the last project. In any organization, there are talent magnets, people who attract the best talent, utilize it to its fullest, and ready it for the next stage. These are leaders who have a reputation not only for delivering results, but for creating a place where young, talented people can grow. They are accelerators to other people's careers. Mitt Romney operated as a talent magnet. He accelerated the career of Meg Whitman, who went on to be CEO of eBay and lead an 88 times increase in revenue. Not only did he have this impact on Meg, Mitt was a magnet and an accelerator in the careers of hundreds of people with a similar story. Perhaps you are a talent magnet. Would your people describe you as someone who recognizes talented people, draws them in, and utilizes them at their fullest? Would they say they have grown more around you than any other manager they have worked for? Or would they describe you as someone who pulled them into your organization not as a talent to be developed, but more as a resource to be deployed and then left to languish? Or would they perhaps say that they were heavily recruited but not given a meaningful role, rather just a visible role, and served as a showpiece or hood ornament in your organization? Some leaders are like magnets that draw in talent and develop it to its fullest. Other leaders acquire resources to build their empire. This chapter explores the difference in these two approaches to the management of talent and the impact that these leaders have on the people around them. The empire builder versus the talent magnet. Multipliers operate as talent magnets. They attract talented people and then use them to their fullest. You might think of it as working at their highest point of contribution. They get access to the best talent not because they are necessarily great recruiters, but rather because people flock to work for them. As Meg Whitman found Mitt Romney, people seek out a talent magnet. They do so knowing their capabilities will be appreciated and knowing their value will also appreciate in the marketplace. In contrast, diminishers operate as empire builders who hoard resources and underutilize talent. They bring in top talent and make big promises, but they underutilize their people and disenchant them. Why? Because they are often amassing the resources for self-promotion and their own gain. Empire builders accumulate people. They collect people like knickknacks in a curio cabinet, on display for everyone to see, but not well utilized. Each of these approaches produces a self-perpetuating cycle. The talent magnet spawns a virtuous cycle of attraction, and the empire builder spawns a vicious cycle of decline. A cycle of attraction. In 1914, Ernest Shackleton, the venerated British explorer, embarked on an expedition to traverse Antarctica. His recruitment advertisement in the Times, London, read, "Men wanted for hazardous journey. Small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success." Surprisingly, hundreds of men applied. Shackleton, with the wisdom of an experienced captain, staffed his crew with men of a certain orientation, men who were attracted to adventure and recognition, but who were also realistically prepared for the hardship they would face. No doubt Shackleton's ability to attract the right team was one key factor in the survival of every member of the expedition. The cycle of attraction begins with a leader possessing the confidence and magnetism to surround him or herself with A players, sheer raw talent and the right mix of intelligence needed for the challenge. under the leadership of the talent magnet, the genius of these players gets discovered and utilized to the fullest. Having been stretched, these players become smarter and more capable. A players become A-plus players. These people are positioned in the spotlight and get kudos and recognition for their work. They attract attention, and their value increases in the talent marketplace, internally or externally. These A-plus players get offered even bigger opportunities and seize them with the full support of the talent magnet. And then the cycle kicks into hyperdrive. As this pattern of utilization, growth, and opportunity occurs across multiple people, others in the organization notice, and the leader and the organization get a reputation. They build a reputation as the place to grow. This reputation spreads, and more A players flock to work in the talent magnet's organization, so there is a steady flow of talent in the door, replacing talent growing out of the organization. This cycle of attraction is exactly what happened to Mitt Romney at Bain & Company and why Meg Whitman knew to join his organization. A talent magnet creates a powerful force that attracts talent and then accelerates the growth of intelligence and capability. These leaders operate like an electromagnetic force that, through interactions between atoms, propels matter in the universe. A cycle of decline. For many years, I had the pleasure of working closely with a colleague named Brian Beckham, a brilliant and affable Canadian. Brian had a reputation for being smart, optimistic, and collaborative, and could solve just about any complex problem that got tossed his way. This reputation earned him a key role as the vice president of operations in a rapidly growing division. The problem was that the division was run by an uncontrolled diminisher and determined empire builder. Brian went to work solving the complex problems of the emerging division. However, he soon found that the SVP running the division didn't really want the underlying issues addressed. The SVP wanted one thing: grow an empire. And he wanted growth at all costs. Brian's role quickly degenerated into window dressing, where he and his team fixed issues on the surface, just enough so the executive committee would continue to fund additional headcount into the organization. For many months, Brian continued to pursue his work at full throttle, but deep problems were festering at the core of the division. With continued indifference from his manager, Brian became numb and started to settle into mediocrity. He lost good players on his team. When other leaders in the company saw the depth of the problems in this division, Brian's Midas touch reputation quickly tarnished. After several years hanging in there, hoping for things to improve, he found himself stuck in a dying organization, watching his opportunities fade. Soon, Brian became one of the walking dead that roamed the halls of so many organizations. On the outside, these zombies go through the motions, but on the inside, they have given up. They quit and stay. It was painful to watch this happen to Brian, whom I knew to be an absolute superstar. No doubt you have seen this happen to colleagues in other organizations, or have even been there yourself. Is it possible that it is happening inside your own organization? Empire builders create a vicious cycle of decline. Talent recruited into their organization soon becomes disengaged and goes stale. The cycle of decline begins much like the cycle of attraction, which is why it is easy to be deceived by diminishers. Empire builders seek to surround themselves with A players, but unlike talent magnets, they accumulate talent to appear smarter and more powerful. The leader glosses over the real genius of the people while placing them into boxes on the org chart. The A players have limited impact and start to look more like A-minus or B-plus. They fail to get noticed for their work, and they lose intellectual confidence. They begin to recede into the shadow of the empire builder. Their value in the job market drops, and opportunities begin to evaporate. So they stay and wait, hoping things will turn around. This cycle of degeneration impacts not only one person, it infects an entire organization. The organization becomes an elephant graveyard, earning a reputation as the place people go to die. As one technology superstar said of his empty vice president job, "I'm definitely past my sell-by date here." The resignation in his voice made it clear, if he were milk, he'd be curdled. Empire builders, having earned their reputation as career killers, continually struggle to get truly top talent into their organizations. Perhaps this is why they labor hard to hoard the resources that they have. Empire builders may initially be able to attract top talent, but their focus on building themselves and their organizations underutilizes the true talent that they have in their organization and renders it stagnant and inert. They generate a cycle of decline that spirals downward. Empire builders hoard resources and underutilize talent. Talent magnets attract talented people and use them at their highest point of contribution. Let's explore the world of the talent magnet, these multipliers who create a cycle of attraction and grow intelligence around them. The talent magnet. The talent magnet creates a cycle of attraction that accelerates performance and grows genius. But does this only work for top talent and for the A players in the market? Or can a true talent magnet find and grow genius everywhere and with everyone? Hexal AG, a maker of generic drugs, is located in a small village close to Munich, Germany. Hexal was founded in 1986 by twin brothers and self-made entrepreneurs, Thomas and Andreas Strungmann. Andreas, a doctor, is the medical authority, and Thomas is the international marketing genius behind Hexal. These brothers teamed their expertise to build a successful generic drug company, growing primarily from the local talent pool in the village. What makes the company unique is that its approach to talent is anything but generic. It is an approach that gets extraordinary results from very ordinary people. It starts with how these leaders hire people into their company. Anyone who has been in the hiring manager's seat knows the process can be painful. To find the right candidate, you know you will waste a lot of time interviewing the wrong candidates. This is particularly frustrating because you typically know they are the wrong candidate in the first 3 minutes of a job interview. But regardless, you feel compelled to proceed with the obligatory 60-minute interview and the pleasantries of, "We'll get back to you." The Strungmann brothers cut right to the chase. When they were looking for a general manager for Hexal in the Netherlands, they began with the normal actions. They engaged an external recruiter, gave her the job requirements, and then waited for a list of candidates. The recruiter brought forward 9 candidates. But then they did something quite unusual. They made arrangements to conduct the interviews in a single day in a rented conference room at Schiphol Airport, just outside Amsterdam. The recruiter reviewed their planned interview schedule and was shocked. They had allowed just 10 minutes per interview. She called to inform them that it was impossible to interview so quickly. The Strungmann brothers disagreed. They met with each candidate for just 3 minutes, every candidate except their final candidate, with whom they spent 3 hours. They explained their unusual approach. "When we consider each person, we ask 1 or 2 questions. If they don't fit, we simply don't continue the conversation. If the person is individualistic, we know that he or she won't fit in our culture. When we find someone who will fit with our company, then we spend a lot of time with this person to make sure we understand their capability and what they would bring to our organization." The Strungmann brothers knew how to spot and attract the right talent. Once people joined Hexal, they discovered another one of the Strungmann's unconventional practices. Hexal doesn't have jobs per se, and they don't have an org chart. This isn't like some elite organizations that choose not to publish their org chart for fear that some other company will snatch up their talent. Hexal didn't have an org chart because the Strungmanns didn't believe in them. Jobs were loosely created around people's interests and unique capabilities. They called their approach the amoeba model. Here's how it works. Ursula's responsibility was to assist the customer services manager. In her role, she saw a large number of repetitive requests for the same action and was continually updating people on the status of these requests. She had an idea to use the internet to create a workflow tracking system. She wrote up a little proposal and sent the idea around to her colleagues in an email asking, "What do you think about it?" Some people replied on email and others stopped by her desk to discuss it in person, but everyone agreed that it was a good idea and wanted to see it happen. She gathered the people she needed, secured some budget, and got the system built through this makeshift team. The team then presented the system to the Strungmann brothers, who applauded their efforts and Ursula's leadership and initiative. These twin brothers simply believed that if an idea got support from a lot of people, it was a good idea. At Hexall, you could work wherever there was energy. Through encouraging their employees to use this heat-seeking approach, they were able to utilize people at their highest point of contribution. They didn't box people into jobs and limit their contribution. They let people work where they had ideas and energy and where they could best contribute. They let talent flow, like an amoeba, to the right opportunities. There are clearly multiple reasons for their success, but it is interesting to note that the Strongman brothers sold Hexall, along with holdings in another company, to Novartis in 2005 for $7.6 billion. At age 55, they were each worth $3.8 billion. As they led Hexall, the Strongman brothers got extraordinary results from very ordinary people. Why? Because these twin talent magnets knew how to unleash people's genius into their organization. How does a talent magnet find and unleash genius? In the four practices of the talent magnet, we find some of the answers. The four practices of the talent magnet. Among the multipliers we studied in our research, we found four active practices that together catalyze and sustain this cycle of attraction. These talent magnets: 1. Look for talent everywhere. 2. Find people's native genius. 3. Utilize people at their fullest. And 4. Remove the blockers. Let's look at each to understand exactly what a talent magnet does to create genius in others. 1. Look for talent everywhere. Talent magnets are always looking for new talent, and they look far beyond their own backyard. Multipliers cast a wide net and find talent in many settings and diverse forms, knowing that intelligence has many facets. Appreciate all types of genius. In 1904, a test of intelligence that later evolved into the IQ test was developed by French researcher Alfred Binet as a tool for assessing the learning progress of French schoolchildren. His assumption was that lower intelligence signaled a need for more and different teaching, not an inability to learn. This tool quickly became ubiquitous as a unilateral determinant of intellectual horsepower. Much work has been done over the last two decades by cognitive psychologists around the world, offering additional methods for identifying and developing intelligence. Whether it is Harvard professor Howard Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences, Daniel Goleman's work on emotional intelligence, or Stanford professor Carol Dweck's work on the effects of mindsets on capability, the message is clear. IQ is a practical but limited measure of the true intelligence of our species. We are simply smarter in more ways than can be measured through an IQ test. A talent magnet knows that genius comes in many forms. Some minds excel at quantitative analysis or verbal reasoning, capabilities measured through IQ, SAT, and other tests of traditional cognitive intelligence. Other minds offer creative genius, innovating through fresh thinking and bold ideas. Some minds are critical, spotting every problem or landmine lurking within a plan. The genius of some others is to find a way to tunnel around these landmines. Bill Campbell, former CEO of Intuit, is one such leader who appreciates the diversity of talent requisite to build a successful company. This economics major and football coach at Columbia University is renowned for his ability to lead and guide Silicon Valley's elite technologists. Bill reflects, "Their minds can do something that mine can't. They have a genius that I don't." He communicates this respect for the intelligence of others through his actions. He readily admits that he doesn't think like they do and that he appreciates what they bring to the table. He listens intently to the ideas and advice of those who offer this perspective he doesn't have, and he asks people to teach him what he doesn't know. This rich appreciation for the genius of others is how this former football coach has become a personal advisor to the CEOs at Apple, Google, and many more. Ignore boundaries. In their quest to assemble the finest talent, talent magnets are blind to organizational boundaries. They see the multiple forms of intelligence that exist everywhere. Talent magnets live in a world without walls and without hierarchical or lateral restrictions. Instead, they see talent networks. You can often spot talent magnets inside organizations because they are the ones who ignore org charts. Org charts are handy for finding out who works for whom and who's in charge if something goes wrong, but these issues are of relative unimportance when you are searching for genius. As far as talent magnets are concerned, org charts are irrelevant. Why? Because everyone works for them, or at least every person whose genius they can uncover. The mind of the multiplier works like this. If I can find someone's genius, I can put them to work. The idea is simple. Multipliers understand that people love to contribute their genius. If they put in the effort to figure out someone's genius, they have opened a pathway for that person to contribute. They can utilize them. Multipliers aren't deterred if someone doesn't officially report to them on an org chart. These leaders see an unlimited talent pool that they can draw from. Everyone works for a multiplier. For this reason, you can often spot multipliers leading cross-functional projects and intercompany ventures. They may be in key staff roles, or they may also be at the top of the org chart. The common denominator is that they look beyond boundaries for talent. Zvi Schreiber, CEO of Ghost, is one such talent magnet. Zvi, the company's British-born Israeli chief executive, started Ghost with the ambition of providing users with a free web-based virtual computer that lets them access their desktop and files from any computer with an internet connection. His business strategy was to break down walls in the computing world. He called the company Ghost for Global Hosted Operating System, because ghosts can go through walls. Zvi took a similar approach to finding the talent he needed to build his company. Headquartered in Modin, Israel, Zvi could have easily built the company with the abundant supply of technical and business talent in Israel, but he could see a rich supply of technically savvy talent in Palestine that became isolated by failed peace agreements. Zvi convinced his venture partner, Benchmark Capital, to make a risky move and support him in building a company that spanned the Israeli-Palestinian divide. The Palestinian office in Ramallah, West Bank, houses about 35 software developers and is responsible for most of the research and programming. The Israeli team is smaller and works about 13 miles away in the Israeli town of Modin. The team works through video conferencing. When face-to-face meetings are necessary, colleagues gather at a run-down coffee shop on a desert road near Jericho, frequented by camels and Bedouin shepherds. This talent magnet not only looked beyond the fabricated borders of organizational structure to find the best talent to staff his company, the boundaries he broke through, borders steeped in cultural, political, and physical conflict, were patrolled by armed guards. Talent magnets look for talent everywhere, and then study that talent to uncover and unlock the real genius that lies within. 2. Find people's native genius. As the head of a global function inside a multinational corporation, I spent a lot of time in cross-functional meetings and on task forces. It was almost inevitable that at some point in these meetings, when things would become murky, someone would hand me the whiteboard pen, point to the front of the room, and say, "Liz, lead us through this." I'd readily jump in and do my thing, and hand back the pen at some point. After a while, I started to wonder why I almost never got to be a regular meeting attendee and sit in the back of the room and check email. I thought, why do I always get asked to lead these difficult meetings? Why am I always getting put in charge when it isn't even my job? After seeing this pattern repeated over many years at work and in other group settings, I realized that I wasn't being asked to be in charge per se. It was a very particular type of in charge. I would find myself in charge when a group needed more of a facilitative leader and less of a boss. I vividly remember one of my colleagues trying to explain to me why I was always getting asked to lead these types of meetings. Ben explained, "It is because you can so easily frame the issue, synthesize what people are saying, and lay out a course of action." "What?" I stared at him blankly, trying to decipher what he was saying. It sounded like he was telling me that I was good at breathing. It didn't strike me as a particularly big deal or something someone might find difficult. It was as easy as breathing. At least it was for me. What my colleagues were teaching me was that I had a native ability, something that I did both easily and freely. Look for what is native. Talent magnets know how to uncover and access the native genius of others. By native genius, I mean something even more specific than a strength or a skill that might be highly rated on a 360-degree leadership assessment. A native genius is something that people do not only exceptionally well, but absolutely naturally. They do it easily, without extra effort, and freely, without condition. What people do easily, they do without conscious effort. They do it better than anything else they do, but they don't need to apply extraordinary effort to the task. They get results that are head and shoulders above others, but they do it without breaking a sweat. What people do freely, they do without condition. They don't need to be paid or rewarded, and they often don't even need to be asked. It is something that gives them inherent satisfaction, and they offer their capability voluntarily, even ardently. It is effortless, and they stand ready and willing to contribute, whether it is a formal job requirement or not. Finding someone's native genius is the key that unlocks discretionary effort. It propels people to go beyond what is required and offer their full intelligence. Finding people's genius begins by carefully observing them in action, looking for spikes of authentic enthusiasm and a natural flow of energy. As you watch someone in action, ask these questions. What do they do better than anything else they do? What do they do better than the people around them? What do they do without effort? What do they do without being asked? What do they do readily without being paid? Label it. Native genius can be so instinctive for people that they may not even understand their own capability. Perhaps you've heard the phrase, "fish discover water last." But if people aren't aware of their genius, they are not in a position to deliberately utilize it. By telling people what you see, you can raise their awareness and confidence, allowing them to provide their capability more fully. Players for Larry Gelwicks, head coach of the almost unbeatable Highland High School rugby team, often report that he got more out of them than other coaches. Consider one specific player, John. Before working with Larry, John saw himself as a good athlete, but not a great one. But Larry pointed out something that changed his view of himself. John recalled, "Larry commented publicly about my speed. John was surprised when the coach started talking in front of the other guys about how fast he was. He continued, "I thought I had good speed, but not great speed. But because Larry singled it out, it inspired me to develop a distinct self-concept. I was fast. And every time I found myself in a situation where speed was required, I remembered this, and I pushed myself beyond my limits." John not only became fast, he became really fast. By labeling his genius for him, Larry unlocked this ability for John. Like John, people's first reaction to hearing someone describe a genius of theirs can often be bemusement. You know you've hit a genius nerve when they say, "Really? Can't everyone do this?" Or, "But this is no big deal." Finding people's native genius and then labeling it is a direct approach to drawing more intelligence from them. 3. Utilize people at their fullest. Once a talent magnet has uncovered the native genius of others, he or she looks for opportunities that demand that capability. Some of these are obvious. Others require a fresh look at the business or the organization. Once they've engaged the person's true genius, they shine a spotlight on them so other people can see their genius in action. Connect people with opportunities. Peter Merrill was a college student hired in a $9-an-hour part-time position as a frontline customer service representative for a professional coaching firm. He took more calls than the average rep and had an almost perfect record of saving customers who called in ready to cancel out of their programs. What would a typical manager do with someone like Peter? Make sure he was happy? Perhaps offer him a full-time job upon graduation? Such a course of action would cement his current level of contribution within the firm and position him, in time, for a promotion. But Ann Kalsa, Peter's manager's manager, wasn't happy with that posture. She dug a little deeper. Peter appeared good at saving customers, but why? It turned out to be what Ann called a listening spike, by which she meant he listened to customers so sincerely and so thoughtfully they would volunteer to give the company another chance. But her curiosity continued. Why was he so good at listening to people? It turned out he had a particular aptitude and interest in helping people break through to the next level in their lives and careers. She tested her hypothesis with people who worked with Peter, and they agreed. They said that his conversation always tilted in that direction, even on lunch breaks. The question for Anne became where to best utilize Peter. She knew he could do good work in customer service, and she gave him rein to make rapid changes there. But she also consciously identified several roles within the company where he could operate at a higher point of contribution. Within 3 weeks of being hired in customer service, at Anne's request, Peter was transferred to the coaching department to work with the company's toughest clients. In that role, he earned more and contributed more as he achieved, amazingly, a zero cancellation rate. But Anne kept tabs on Peter, trying to figure out what opportunity would further increase Peter's personal net worth while providing significantly more value to the organization. She cracked the code when she mentioned to Peter that he might want to set up a product line based on the ideas he had developed in his coaching work. He went from being a strong individual contributor to a successful leader within the company. 12 months from the time he was hired as a part-time customer service representative, Peter launched the highest margin product in the company, adding $2 million in annual revenue to the company. The difference is more than a tenfold increase in value from the same employee. This art of connecting people's genius to opportunities that allow them to be used at their highest point of contribution is a natural but deliberate management approach for Anne. She doesn't need to take her team to off-site meetings to analyze their different personality types. Instead, she watches people until she has an idea of what they do effortlessly and what area they are naturally drawn to. Then she has an ongoing conversation with herself about where this person's aptitude could benefit the company. Could there be people in your customer service department who would produce $1 million in value if they were unleashed on the right opportunity? Are there people on your team who are being blocked from working at a higher point of contribution? Shine a spotlight. Each summer in the Sierra Mountains of California, roughly 75 teenage girls eagerly gather for an annual girls' camp, a week of fun, adventure, and camaraderie that often serves as a watershed event in their young lives. The camp is run entirely on the volunteer efforts of 60 leaders. For the last 6 years, Marguerite Hancock has served, also as a volunteer, as the camp director at the helm of this incredible group of youth and leaders. Marguerite works as a Stanford University research director and teacher and is smart, accomplished, and extraordinarily capable. She is a strong leader with strong ideas of her own. One of her assistant directors said, "Marguerite is so capable, she could do virtually any aspect of girls' camp herself." But what is interesting about Marguerite isn't that she could, it is that she doesn't. Instead, she leads like a multiplier, invoking brilliance and dedication in the other 59 leaders who make this camp a reality. Marguerite begins by building a dream team, carefully recruited for each person's individual strengths. One of the assistant directors said, "Marguerite studies people. She watches them until she figures out what they are great at. She chose her assistant directors not only for their strengths, but because we each had strengths in areas where she was weak. She then finds a place where each person's strengths will shine. For some, it is working with the girls one-on-one. For another, it is managing the sports program. For another, it is leading the nightly campfire. But each role is carefully cast to draw upon the unique talents of every person on the team." Marguerite then makes it clear to each person why she has been selected for that role. She not only notices their talent, she labels it for them. One camp leader said, "She tells me the talent she sees in me and why it matters. She tells me why girls' camp will be better because of me and my work." But Marguerite doesn't stop there. She lets everyone else know, too. It is typical for her to introduce someone to the group by saying, "This is Jennifer. She's a creative genius, and we are so fortunate to have her leading our art program." With her cast of talent assembled, Marguerite then goes to the back of the room, takes control of the spotlight, and begins shining it on others. She is effusive with praise, but it is never empty. Her praise of others' work is specific, and it is public. The other leaders at camp can see the direct link between their work and the success of the camp. A camp leader said, She not only tells you that you are doing a great job, but she tells you why it matters to these girls. I know my work is appreciated. Marguerite finds other people's genius and then shines a spotlight on it for everyone to see their talent in action. What is the result? A character-building, life-changing experience for 75 young women, but also a deeply rewarding, growing experience for the 59 leaders who serve along with Marguerite. 4. Remove the blockers. Talent magnets are attractors and growers of talent and intelligence. Leaders who serve as multipliers provide both the space and the resources to yield this growth. But talent magnets go beyond just giving people resources. They remove the impediments, which quite often means removing the people who are blocking and impeding the growth of others. In almost every organization, there are people who overrun others, consuming the resources needed to fuel the growth of people around them. Like weeds in a garden bed, they choke the development of the intelligence around them. Get rid of prima donnas. Bloom Energy, located in the heart of Silicon Valley, had developed a fuel system that produces clean, reliable, and affordable energy. As venture capital firm Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield & Byers' first green tech venture, Bloom Energy has become a leader in their industry. Leading Bloom Energy is K.R. Sridhar, renowned aerospace and environmental scientist and an energy thought leader. When K.R. Sridhar started Bloom Energy, he began with what he calls gene pool engineering. K.R. explains, A players attract other A players. Their smarts and passion make other smart, passionate people want to work here. So, your first 50 employees are the most important and hardest. When Bloom Energy needed to hire their first 50 employees, there was no established green tech industry at the time. So, KR broke down each technology they would require to build their energy generators and identified the leading company in this technology. He then researched and found the person inside each company that the company would least want to lose. He reached out to these people, explained the bold challenge Bloom Energy was undertaking, and recruited them to join the company. He engineered a gene pool of elite technical talent who were the best in their respective fields. He now had the talent he needed, and the work of building a team that would deliver an integrated energy technology began. He established one rule: no prima donnas. Leave your ego at the door and work as a team. Within this elite team, one technologist was particularly indispensable. Stefan, an outstanding scientist, was the world expert in the technology that was the linchpin in their solution. As the team worked, it became clear that Stefan couldn't collaborate and had become entrenched in his position about the technical direction the company should pursue. Tensions mounted in the team because the company had just committed to an important beta release in 18 months. KR pulled Stefan into his office and explained the situation, but Stefan wouldn't back down. Knowing how essential he was to the technical viability of the venture, he made it clear to KR it was either him or the team. KR explained the options, but Stefan's ego wouldn't allow him to let go of the issue. KR contemplated the issue and the risks involved. Within the hour, he had made his decision. He chose the team. He walked Stefan to the door, then walked over to the rest of the team and explained his actions. "I have put us at significant risk, but I know we have it in us to overcome this. I trust that we will get through this, but there will be significant delays," he explained. Initially, the group was silent, stunned that KR was willing to let go of their top technologist. One team member broke the silence and said, "There will be no delays. We will do things we have never done before to get this done." With renewed energy, the team worked weekends and extraordinary hours. They brought in consultants with the critical expertise they lacked. They kept up the pace for 18 months while people grew to fill in the gap that was created by Stefan's departure. They delivered the product successfully, missing their original deadline by only 2 days. This incident became the foundation for how the company would operate, the best talent in the industry, but not a single prima donna. Today, Bloom Energy is thriving and is often cited as the reason Kleiner Perkins can